the show. This is the Alternative Media. I am your host, Patrick Slattery. Farron is still off on his important mission. He will be back. He will be back sooner or later. He will be back. But today we've got a great show. We've got a couple of great guests every hour. This first hour, I am pleased to introduce to the radio public Dr. Andrew Joyce, originally from Ireland. He spoke with me earlier today. I'm going to be playing that interview right now. Dr. Andrew Joyce, welcome to the Alternative Media. I understand that you you do a lot of research into a lot of areas of what we could call Jewish studies. And you were just telling me about some of your research into the renowned, the well-known Jewish philosopher Spinoza. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. First of all, Patrick, I would like to say that it's a real pleasure to be on the show and to make my first foray into radio. But yes, Spinoza. The whole article that I wrote on Spinoza came about really by pure chance. I was sitting in a library working on something completely unrelated when an email popped up from Kevin MacDonald. And the email was basically a link to this book by Jonathan Israel, who had offered a radical revision of the Enlightenment in which he placed Spinoza as this crucial kingpin, this fulcrum upon which the whole of Western thought rotated. And at the end of the link, Kevin had written some kind of sarcastic comment to the effect of, "Well, here we go again. This will be grist to your mill." But something about it stuck with me even when I read the blurb of Israel's book. And it just so happened, sitting there in the library, that I was only a few shelves away from a whole section on Spinoza. And there were probably upwards of 100 books there. So I stopped what I was doing, and I walked towards the bookshelves, and sure enough, there was Israel's book, and there were many more. So I decided that for the rest of that day, and subsequently it ended up being a few more days, and then that turned into a few more weeks, I spent a great deal of time working my way through all of those books, beginning with the earliest reception of Spinoza's work, and moving my way up to the present. And as I did so, and this didn't surprise me, you know, terrifically, but as I did so, I discovered that there was a marked difference between reception of Spinoza's work by Jewish scholars and his reception by non-Jewish scholars. Mm. So I started to sort these authors out into groups. You know, I decided that I was going to start to analyze the arguments that were being made. And on top of all of it, of course, I dipped a little bit into Spinoza's work myself just to try and wrap my head around my own personal conception of how important this guy may have been within the Enlightenment. And I came away with a number of conclusions. The first was that Spinoza really wasn't anything particularly special. The second was that this seemed to me to be yet another case of the construction of Jewish genius. Mm-hmm. And that this is the process by which Jews take someone of moderate significance. You know, let's not be too hard on Spinoza here. He became known, but he wasn't of world significance. His writings weren't world-shattering or world-changing. But Jewish scholars, Jewish activists, have a tendency to group around anyone even of moderate significance and really elevate them to a status that is far out of proportion to the true character and nature of their work. And this is precisely what was happening with mm-hmm. Spinoza. So the article that I wrote then for the Occidental Observer was framed in that context. It was an analysis not so much of Spinoza, but of ethnic networking in academia, in the media, mm-hmm. and really, I also wanted to get to the bottom of why are Jews so keen to elevate particular individuals among them? What was it about Spinoza's philosophy that was useful? Because certainly in his lifetime, Spinoza was hated by Jews. He was an apostate, and he was very, very critical of the Jewish way of life and of Judaism. That only changed over time because, as I argue in the article, Jews became aware of the utility of his kind of universalist, read anything into it kind of philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the construction of Jewish genius and Jewish ethnic networking. I sometimes talk about, or other people talk about, Jewish mutual promotion. They have a kind of a mutual admiration society. And, yeah, you mentioned academia. I remember in my own graduate work or PhD level work, fully half of my professors, this was in political science, fully half of my professors were Jewish. And the Jewish professors, if you looked at, I haven't done a formal analysis of this, but I know that if I went back to my syllabi, if I looked at the reading lists assigned by the Jewish professors and those assigned by the non-Jewish professors, the Jewish professors would probably assign about 2/3 Jewish authors, and maybe the non-Jewish ones would still assign about 1/3 Jewish authors. But there's this promotion, and the Jewish authors are most, the Jewish professors are more likely to assign Jewish authors. And then I think of some, you know, media programs, Democracy Now, for instance, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but it's got a Jewish host, but it's aimed at non-mainstream leftist audience. And the hostess, Amy Goodman, always, she just had a guest list that was so skewed to Jews, and then if not Jewish, non-white. And very few non-Jewish whites. And you see this also just in other shows, especially shows where there is a Jewish host or Jewish producer. And then, of course, you have the Academy Awards or the Pulitzer Prizes, which were created by Jews largely to celebrate the work of other Jews, to talk about their genius. And then perhaps the most extreme example, you have somebody like Albert Einstein, who really was a genius. I don't care what other people might say. He was a genius, but he is portrayed as the most intelligent person who ever lived, and that's the stretch. And so, you know, whether you're talking about just very insignificant people, Amy Goodman, just to go back to her, she once, it was amazing. When events took place in other countries, you know, she would bring on an Iranian, but it was a Jewish Iranian, or Chilean, a Jewish Chilean. And then once something was going on in Japan, and she brought on somebody who she described as the head of the largest foreign-run labor union in Japan. Well, guess what? It was a Jew, and guess what? They don't really have foreign-run labor unions in Japan. Any labor union in Japan is going to be run by the Japanese. They're very capable of doing these things. And so it's just some young Jewish kid, and that's how she brought him on. But Spinoza, getting back to Spinoza, he's somebody who may have been interesting, but he's at least among intellectuals, at least among philosophy students, certainly a household name. But his work, are you saying it's just basically you can read into it whatever you want to read into it?
Yes, that's an aspect of it, but I think that the most important story at the heart of the whole promotion of Spinoza is that, you know, Spinoza is a household name. There's no taking that away from him. But the whole Jewish effort to promote him was with the aim of getting him to this kind of level of cosmic significance. In other words, there would have been no enlightenment without Spinoza. Mm-hmm. This is what's argued by Jewish intellectuals today. And in the article, you know, the number of books being produced by Jewish scholars arguing this frankly ridiculous point, is astronomical. And these Jewish scholars are publishing these tracts and books, making this suggestion through elite publishing houses. So, you know, I'm not going to argue that Spinoza was completely unimportant. My personal opinion is that overall he was very derivative in his philosophy, and the most of the good things that we read in it were borrowed from much more significant thinkers. But, you know, we come back to this really bare-faced, audacious claim that without Spinoza there would have been no enlightenment. And it contributes to an atmosphere and a perception. You mentioned people like Amy Goodman, and you know, the Pulitzer Prize and the Academy Awards. All of these little things contribute to a perception. And Jews are very keen to manage the perception held by Gentiles or non-Jews of Jews. And it seems to me that one of the developments of the late 20th century and early 21st century is that the image that Jews are keen to portray of themselves, if any, because I think actually they prefer to be quite anonymous and to go under the radar. But whenever people do think of Jews, they are now to think of Jews as having this sparkling and amazing intelligence. We are supposed to believe that without Jewish input, our world as it exists today would simply not be feasible or possible. And yes, that goes for elevating Einstein to the status of a man more intelligent than any other who ever lived. But even it goes right down to the smallest level. There's a TV show that actually my wife used to watch called Numbers. And the main characters of this show were two Jewish mathematicians who also solved murders in their spare time, or solved like really complex crimes. So here were two guys who, I'm not sure if they were ever explicitly described or it was made explicit that they were Jewish, but in their mannerisms and the way they talked, and you know, everything was amplified. Plus their appearance of both actors. I think both actors actually were Jewish as well. But the whole emphasis of the show was on here. Here were these super intelligent Jews solving crimes that the stupid non-Jewish police couldn't quite manage. And also, it crosses national boundaries. In the United Kingdom, there are individuals like Stephen Fry, who hosts not only quite a lot of award ceremonies where his really quite mediocre speeches are fawned over by a Jewish-dominated press, but also he hosts game shows which are supposedly the most difficult, most intellectually challenging on television. So as you say, there's a lot of this mutual appreciation society going on where Jews are giving each other a pat on the back on a very regular basis and on quite a high level. But I think a very significant offshoot of this phenomenon is that the Gentiles are meant to pick up on this perception that the Jews are their intellectual superiors, and also that when they think of a Jew, the first image that's to spring to mind is this indispensable genius. The truth is completely different. But this is the lie that's being fed to the population.
Mm-hmm. So, and they're able to gain for themselves this type of reputation by exploiting ethnic networking, by creating these mutual admiration societies. I have done research into Elena Kagan, who is one of the Supreme Court justices in the United States. She's the youngest of our Supreme Court justices, and it's not that uncommon to appoint a relatively young person, somebody in the late 40s or early 50s, to the Supreme Court, because that way you know the president doing the appointment, their influence lasts for that much longer, seeing as these are lifetime appointments. But Elena Kagan was a very interesting case study in Jewish networking. and I did publish this on Occidental Observer. She, first of all, if you look at her life coming up, she was continually a recipient of Jewish networking favors. Of so her internships were with, you know, as a student were with her Jewish congresswoman. She was given positions, teaching positions from heads of, well, the head of the University of Chicago Law School, Gerald Stone, a Jewish man, hired her and then gave her tenure without her having ever really published anything, which is pretty much unheard of. Lawrence Summers, who was just got this horrible history of, I mean, he was one of the people that advised Yeltsin in such a way that the Jewish oligarchs in Russia took over the economy, took over all of the assets of the Russian people and caused a, you know, demographic collapse of the ethnic Russians. Lawrence Summers, when he was president of Harvard, handed over the Harvard Law School to her. She became dean of Harvard Law School without having really anything like the prerequisite qualifications. And then, of course, while she was at Harvard, she hired 30 or so, about 30 tenure-track professors. And when she was appointed to the Supreme Court, again, without, I think she had argued all of one case before the Supreme Court. She did not have the prerequisite background. Some on Democracy Now, you had this Jewish discussion of her because a couple of non-white professors at second-tier law schools were complaining that she had not hired enough non-whites. She had not hired people of color. Only one of these people was a non-white, and of course that provoked my own curiosity. I looked into it. They were always talking about her, these 30 people she hired, and only one being non-white, but not providing a list of names. And I wanted to see the list of names. I was able to generate a list of names by going to the Wayback Machine, the Internet Archives, looking at what the list of the Harvard Law School was the month that she took it over, and then the month that she left. Doing the math and finding, generating this list, and lo and behold, it was half Jewish. So, in terms of non-Jewish whites, even though America is a majority non-Jewish white country, you had a minority non-Jewish white appointees. Yet, it was she was being accused of exercising white privilege, and so that was the case study. And no talk of Jewish privilege, and.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure you see all sorts of examples of this, where to the extent that Jews are ever called out for ethnic networking, it's not even as Jews, but as whites.
Well, that's certainly the case, and certainly they go incognito when they want to. Jewish identity really is a shell game, and you know, when it suits them to be seen as Jews and seen in a certain light as Jews, they will be all over it. We know that when it comes to playing the victim card.
Okay, well, that music tells us that it's time to get ready for our commercial break. We will be back after the break with more with Dr. Andrew Joyce. Back with more of our interview with Dr. Andrew Joyce.
As a badge of honor, but when it comes to issues of, as you say, privilege, or when the particular game of networking that they are playing attracts scrutiny, then it is time to claim white identity. Mm. and played that, and that is a double poison for the white population, because then we end up getting blamed for things that we haven't done, and it's part of the Jewish MO. But the Kagan case is very, very interesting, and the fact that this woman was elected to the Supreme Court really illustrates the fact that democracy itself is very deeply flawed. Now, I know there are systems of appointments and everything that go on, and this is supposedly part of the democratic process, but there's no such thing as a purely democratic society. Democracy doesn't operate at all levels, and it certainly doesn't operate behind the scenes and behind the elections that we are told give us, the people, power over who governs us. An excellent example is the story of how hate speech laws were introduced into the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, really, that story goes back to just after World War II, when the Jewish terrorists in Palestine were struggling with the British administration there, for control. They wanted to create the Jewish state. The British were resisting it. The British wanted to build something up more gradually over time. And in response, the Irgun committed a large number of atrocities. On one occasion, known as the Sergeant's Affair, they actually got two British sergeants and beat them almost to death and hung their bodies in a eucalyptus grove, and then booby-trapped the bodies so that when their comrades came to retrieve the bodies, they too would be killed or badly maimed by the explosives. Now, this event sent a shockwave through Britain, as did the bombing of the King David Hotel in 1946. A lot of the sympathy for Jews that was drummed up at the end of World War II in Britain really started to dry up. There were a number of riots against Jews, and Jewish stores were damaged, and graffiti started appearing on walls saying Hitler was right. And in response, there were communist Jewish networks within the Labour Party. And at the 1946 Labour Party conference, this Jewish network worked together to propose and float a new law. And this law would basically make anti-Semitism or any kind of anti-Jewish statement illegal, as it, of course, it had already been made illegal in the Soviet Union. Now, it was defeated. But in 1948, they attempted again. And again, it was defeated at the first reading. But all through the 1950s, there were 9 attempts in 9 years to pass anti-Semitism legislation, really over the heads of the British people. They had asked for anything of this nature. It wasn't something that was being commonly discussed as a matter of pressing concern. After the creation of the State of Israel, some of the anti-Jewish attacks started to die down. People's memories were short. The issue had gone. But the organized Jewish community in Britain at that time, really, the ball had started to roll, and they wanted to keep it rolling. So they utilized a number of different tactics. There was the explicit, okay, Jewish members of parliament and politicians are going to keep proposing this. We're going to keep pushing it behind the scenes with networking and assisting each other. But then in 1965, a group libel bill was actually tabled by the then Home Office Minister Frank Soskis, who was the son of Russian-Jewish revolutionary immigrants. And this law finally got passed. Now, it wasn't specifically a hate speech law, nor was it...
Okay, and I hear another break coming on. We will be back afterwards with more from Professor Andrew Joyce. on the Alternative Media. And tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Send it.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Interview with Professor Andrew Joyce.
No, it wasn't specifically a hate speech law, nor was it sort of explicitly coming down on people for what they might say. But what it did do was it created something called a race relations board, a product of the Race Relations Act, which would sponsor research from supposedly independent bodies with a view to extending legislation in the future, based on the findings of these research institutes, these think tanks, basically. But whenever I started taking a little bit of a deeper look back into the history of all this, I discovered that it was very clear that these research bodies were far from independent and were staffed mainly by Jews. So here you have a Home Office, a Jewish Home Office minister, who's creating a law which is really, you can tell, is aimed to significantly shift Britain away from free speech. And he's giving the research powers designed to come up with these future laws to institute bodies that are run basically by Jews. The most influential of these bodies, for example, was the Political and Economic Planning Institute, or PEP. Its major focus was on race, and certainly its 1977 publication, its main publication, was described at the time as the Bible of the race relations lobby in Britain. PEP is very interesting. It certainly was not independent. The closest analogy that I could use would be the NAACP.
Mm-hmm. And does this race relations board still function today?
It certainly does. It operates under a new name, but I'm not familiar with the new. I can't remember offhand. But this is still in operation today. But one of the closest political associates of the PEP was the National Committee for Commonwealth Immigrants, NCCI. And you know, it's basically a carbon copy of the NAACP, in that ostensibly and on the surface, here's an organization meant to advance the interests of blacks. And, you know, certainly there were a number of black spokesmen, and it was all about how this new black population, which had come from nowhere really in the 1950s to develop at a rapid pace in Britain, how it needed representation, and it was the victim of white racism and everything else. But much like the NAACP, when you looked at the leadership, it wasn't black, nor was it Indian or Pakistani. It was staffed almost exclusively by Jews. And you know, the extent of networking just carried on and on and on. In 1965, Frank Soskus, the Jewish Home Office Minister, managed to have the NCCI appointed as an advisor to the government on racial matters. Mm-hmm. So you see, no one voted for any of these developments. It just organically developed as a result of Jewish networking. The chief lawyer running the NCCI was a Jewish lawyer called Anthony Lester. Mm-hmm. And Lester was directly involved in subsequently drafting almost the entirety of British race relations legislation. And he actually founded yet another race relations think tank called the Runnymede Trust, along with a fellow Jew named Jim Rose. So again, it expanded, you know, this multiplication of different groups, of different think tanks and research bodies, and again and again and again, all of these people know each other.
Mm-hmm.
All of these, a lot of them went to college together. They associated the same social clubs and everything, and it just keeps snowballing. Another really interesting mm-hmm. point is that Lester was later appointed to act as a special advisor, again an unelected special advisor to Roy Jenkins, who was the non-Jewish successor to Frank Soskis at the Home Office. And while he was there, Lester basically enjoyed a huge level of influence over Jenkins. He criticized the 1965 Act as not going far enough, and he kept pushing the whole thing forward. Progress was slow until in 1985, a Jewish member of parliament named Harry Cohen emerged to introduce a racial harassment bill to parliament, which failed. He tried again a year later. And it was only in 1986 that racial harassment clause was introduced into the Public Order Act that year in 1986. But the Public Order Act was drafted for very different reasons. There had been a miners' strike that year. It just so happened that the Home Office Minister was yet again another Jew, this time Leon Britton.
Mm-hmm.
And he was assisted by another Jewish MP named Malcolm Rifkind, and together they just snuck this racial clause into a Public Order Act designed to stop miners rioting, I believe, in Wales. So there's the whole story of the restriction of free speech. Sorry, in Britain is a history not only of Jewish ethnic networking, but exploiting just about every loophole and gap in the democratic system that it is possible to exploit.
Well, that reminds me of how, at least one provision of hate crime laws came into effect in the United States. I was talking to a congressman who had run for president, he was relatively well known, Dennis Kucinich, at a public function, and he had been telling the audience there had been just for that year every year there was a defense appropriations bill, and he was always against the wars and the all the money that was going to defense, but he had confessed that he was tempted to vote for it that year because anti-hate crime legislation or an anti-hate crime provision had been tucked into it. And this is the type of thing. The Defense Appropriations Bill is going to pass. At least it was going to pass in that pro-war environment of, the George Bush administration. It was going to pass, yet, and Kucinich was against it, yet, and wound up voting against it, apparently, but admitted to being tempted to vote for it, in his case, because he was in favor of the hate crimes. But the reason it gets tucked in there is the opposite, because all of the Republican pro-war senator or congressman at the time would not have been as disposed to voting for hate crimes legislation. But this is the type of thing that happens, that they'll... attach an amendment to some other form of legislation, and there's two.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there. excuse me. There's the some very famous ones that have to do with Jewish immigration to the United States. One was the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, and it was an amendment, I believe, to an omnibus trade bill, something that was likely to pass anyway. But the Jackson-Vanik Amendment of early 1970s tied trade relations with the Soviet Union to their allowing for a Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union into the United States and into Israel, maybe a little bit into Western Europe as well, but those were the primary targets. And then there was a Lautenberg Amendment. There are two Lautenberg Amendments. One had to do with gun regulation, which we can talk about later, but the other Lautenberg Amendment, which was stuck onto some piece of legislation, provided a special class of refugees. They were refugees who did not have to prove or provide any evidence that they were personally being persecuted. Simply, they were a member of a persecuted group. That would be enough. So any Jews from the Soviet Union were covered by it. And then there was a couple of small groups, small ethnic groups from Indochina, who were thrown in just for window dressing. But so that's certainly a pattern to just stick something of Jewish interest onto a piece of legislation that you know is going to pass anyway and get it through without an up-and-down vote on it due to its merits.
Exactly. Jews have become very aware of the fact, just through a process of trial and error, that whenever they try to pass a law that benefits them really explicitly or even solely, I mean, looking back on it now in retrospect, it was really very amateurish of them to try and pass a law outlawing anti-Semitism in Britain in the 1940s and 50s. It strikes me as rash and almost silly. But what they've discovered through trial and error is that the best way of furthering legislative Jewish interests is by just, you know, slipping them into pieces of legislation that the public or the parliament or the Congress really does want to see pass. But the way that they do this is simply by networking and by occupying, as I said, all of the loopholes and gaps in the democratic system. Those unelected appointees, those special advisors, Jews have become magnificent operators at seizing, controlling, exchanging, and dominating the kind of the black holes that permeate the democratic process. And so much of it goes over the head of the general public. You ask the average citizen in the United States or France or Germany or Britain or wherever it might be, of how much say they have in the actions that their government takes. And they have this almost mythical, spiritual view of their vote. They view their vote as omnipotent, and a government can rise or fall on their say-so. But really, that's just absolutely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
We vote for we have a menu placed in front of us, and the menu contains some very limited options indeed. And behind that menu, we don't know what ingredients go into the dish we are subsequently served. And certainly, there are quite a few secret ingredients that are snuck in there, and we're fed a daily diet of increasingly restrictive legislation, which is bit by bit taking away more and more of our freedoms, and all the while, people continue to sing the praises of modern parliamentary democracy. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me you use the metaphor of a menu, because it's similar to the way I look at it. I sometimes talk about a bill of goods, but these prepackaged bills of goods. The way I see American politics is you had the Democratic Party captured several decades ago, and they have been the main avenue of pushing a Jewish social agenda or a Jewish domestic agenda. And then later, maybe 25, 30 years ago, they started to capture the Republican Party as well. And they use the Republicans as their avenue for their foreign policy agenda, which maybe the Democrats could... the Democrats in the 70s could push for aid for Israel, but of course now especially since the end of the Cold War, the Jewish foreign policy agenda has become much more expansive because it's all these wars for Israel the regime changes in countries around the Middle East, which is something that during the Cold War was too dangerous to pursue. And and as a result of the Cold War, you had a Republican Party that whose establishment was much actually much more interventionist and militaristic. So they wound up capturing the Republican Party as well. And so you have this illusion, maybe not even illusion, but you certainly have this scenario carried out where the two parties seem to, you know, they're at odds with each, not just at odds with each other, but to the point where sometimes everything grinds down into a gridlock. They are very much against each other, but it's the way I look at it, it's very rigged, because at the end of the day, the Republicans usually are going to get their way with this pro-Jewish foreign policy, and the Democrats get their way with the Jewish agenda for social policy. And it doesn't matter, the Jewish social policy doesn't get rolled back when you have a Republican administration. You know, the gay marriage and or abortion or whatever you want to look at that supposedly the Republicans are against, that never got rolled back when you had George Bush as president, and all of these overseas wars that Obama was elected to pull us out of, they just went on. The occupations, new invasions just went on with Obama. So it's kind of a ratcheting effect. Anything you want to comment about that, I'm interested in hearing. And I'm also interested in hearing about the history of Jews in Britain. And I know you're from Ireland. I can tell from your accent. I don't know what history they have in Ireland, but Britain, there's obviously some history. They were mentioned in the original Magna Carta. They've been kicked out of Britain. You had the British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli in the 1800s. And now you're talking about, you know, Jewish community in Britain now. And I was wondering about the Jewish community, how long they've been in Britain, how many are more recent emigres?
I'll deal with your first point first. This issue about Jewish support, kind of backing both horses in the race. I think what it really boils down to this business of backing both horses. That really began with modern parliamentary democracy. When you look back before that, Jews were basically in cahoots with the elite, whether that happened to be a king. Dictators or emperors, whoever the elite may have been, or it could have been elites of the nobles, if that's who held most sway in that society at that particular time. Jews have always favored very, very strong government.
And we will be back with one more segment with Professor Andrew Joyce. I'm Patrick Slattery, and this is our last segment for today with Professor Andrew Joyce.
Jews have always favored very, very strong government. This is one of the lies that the Jews like to disseminate, is this idea that they don't like strong government. And they point to 1933, to 1945, and say, look what happens when there's a strong government, et cetera, et cetera. But no, the great span of Jewish history over the last 2,000 years really very clearly illustrates that Jews feel most safe and most comfortable when a population is oppressed by a very powerful elite. And before the advent of modern parliamentary democracy, Jews occupied a middleman role. So, for example, in the sphere of tax farming, the Jewish population would basically approach the monarch and say, hey, look, this gathering all the taxes from these peasants can't be much fun. Some of them might not pay you. You know, it's too. You've got more important kingly things to deal with. Here's what we'll do: if we give you a upfront fee, an upfront down payment in cash or gold or silver, whatever it may have been. You, in return, will give grant us the rights to collect all the taxes in the realm. And because we've given you so much money, we might get to keep all of the taxes that we collect through our efforts. Or if we've just given you some kind of a down payment, upfront cash advance, then we can take a cut or a share of the taxes that we levy. Now, this obviously didn't endear the Jewish population to the population at large, because the Jewish population now had elite backing. Sometimes this translated to access to the elite armed militia, so the population could fear violence from the elite if they didn't pay up. And not only if they didn't pay up, but if they didn't pay the new tariff, which is now being levied at a higher rate, because you know, the Jewish population want their cut, and they want to make sure that the enterprise is profitable. So cozying up to elites is something that Jews have a long history of doing. One of the things that we're seeing most recently in this sphere of activity, this look, this search for security from the elite, from the government, is the Jewish quest for heightened gun control laws.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very little known rabbinic commentary. I think it's pronounced Pirkei Avot. I think that's pretty much how it's pronounced. But it's an injunction that tells Jews to, and I quote, "Pray for the welfare of the government, because if it were not for the fear it inspires," and I want to emphasize that, the fear it inspires, "every man would swallow his neighbor alive." Now, that might sound like a general praise for a government that keeps law and order, but it has a much more specific application than that. This injunction is really that they should pray for the welfare of the government, because the fear that the power and force of that government inspires in the populace will basically stop the Jewish community from being swallowed alive by his neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is a fear of the general population, the non-Jewish population, and we've seen that most recently after these Muslim attacks in Paris, for example. There were immediate kind of outcries for Jews to have, and synagogues to have, special police protection. This insatiable craving for strengthened government powers, increased police protection, and guarding of synagogues and protection of Jews. And gun control is another aspect of that. It's very, very uncomfortable for Jewish organizations and many Jewish groups for the population of the United States to have access to arms. It's simply unconscionable to these groups, given their agenda and their wish to advance their power.
Okay, and that's all the time we have for this interview for this week, but there's plenty more. You'll hear it next week. So tune in next week, same bat time, same bat channel.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.